the best thing I have going for me. Yeah. It's taught me a lot.
So I wasn't so sure about it when it first happened.
Well, that's always the case.
A lot of times, God, what were you doing? What were you thinking? What was...
Well, I think, I don't know anyone, I don't know anyone who, when something really rough comes in, right away, oh yeah, God's,
teaching me something.
God's teaching me this, and I'm happy about it, and I know what he's teaching me, right? And when it happens, if it's going to teach you anything, it's got to throw you for a loop. Or
that's not what even the
you.
Scriptures say. They don't say it like that.
No, they don't.
The things that would change our mind happen over a period of time, because it says at first it's not pleasant.
No.
No.
And usually for something to get our attention, it has to hit some fundamental...
Yeah.
It has to knock out some fundamental stones in our foundation that shouldn't be there.
Ask this. Have you ever been in a position where you believe you were going to die?
No, I haven't yet.
I have like 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was riding a motorcycle out in the middle of nowhere.
Out in the dirt.
Nobody knew where I was at. And when I say I was in the middle of nowhere, that's where I live. And I didn't tell anybody where I went. I went over the top of a, like this, and I ran the handlebar in my chest. And I fell over, and I wasn't a believer. And I looked up, and I could hear that motorcycle running full bore. And I thought, you know what? It's the end of me. And I closed my eyes to die right there. It's not that hard to say I'm going to die. And I wasn't even a believer. I just closed my eyes, and I don't know how long I laid there until I woke up and that motorcycle was dead. And lucky I kick-started that thing off, and I got it back, and I never rode it after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other time, what was it? That one, it was the same thing. You just... It was before, it was a motorcycle again, and I had hit, and I flew through the air, and I could see the motorcycle tumbling underneath me, and I landed on a pile of posts, and I think it knocked me out. I had a helmet on, that's probably the only thing I hit. And in the air, I went, I'm dead. And you can actually say, I'm dead, and you can just, and I can, when I'm sitting there listening to her, you, the closer you get to it, there's a part of me that says you lose your fear of it.
I don't know. I can't even imagine. I'm trying to imagine being in her shoes and deciding not. And then it's like, but you're going to be right with Jesus after that. How can you... I can't... doesn't matter whether I can conceive of it or not, but it's just...
Hard
to think about that.
You have a foundation where you know what Jesus thinks about it. And
right.
That's a big difference.
So do you still ride motorcycles?
No.
Nope.
Okay.
I never rode around after that.
Oh, yes, you did.
Well,
you bought that.
I did that. But I did it. But I did that. Didn't last very long.
No, I did. A couple of months.
I forgot about that.
That was the end of that.
But all I'm saying about the thing is if you think death is going to scare you, I don't think it really does. You just accept the fact that it's going to happen. And I'm wondering about her. It's an escape. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of playing this game. You talk to other sick people, and I'm tired of the poking, and I'm tired of the...
And it's like, I'm ready to go home, and God hasn't taken me yet.
Yeah, and I want to go, and I just... And our conversation...
But it's going to happen.
It's
right.
going to happen, but we're not sitting there we haven't sat in her spot.
No.
Yeah, but to do that
and
yourself
we,
and
we, I know we're throwing
Jesus.
This at her. And and I'm sorry, but if I was in her shoes, I'd be reading it probably somewhat different than you right now.
Well,
if
sure.
she hasn't had that foundation.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I know.
That's kind of my point, is that people think, the foundation is so important,
mm-hmm.
because by the time it becomes real important, you're past the point of being able to, you can't cram. It's like people that, it's like somebody who says, okay, well, I'm a new believer, I'm going to lock myself in a room for a week and study Revelation and master it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Right? you're just going to end up with a problem trying to do that. And there, God is, you know, the scriptures and sanctification of God, he's not a have it your way, you know, go to McDonald's thing.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time and it, you know, it takes a lot of things. And that's why we're in these Bible studies on a weekly basis. I mean, it's, there's an aspect of it, you know, I'll say the word, it's, there's an aspect that's drudgery
mm-hmm.
at times.
Doesn't,
it's not always joyful to be.
Doesn't God hold you responsible for what you know?
Well, sure.
Okay. And if you don't know, then
you're still responsible, yeah.
Well,
sins
are
of ignorance.
You really?
Well, yeah, sins of ignorance, sure.
If it's why everybody's responsible, you know, in the whole world for not believing or believing there is a God,
yeah.
And not being thankful, that's in Romans 1.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, beyond that point, there are people out there that are more sophisticated, and some that are way less sophisticated, like some people, Christians, who believe, you know, you just kind of talking about it, believe that it's okay to have an abortion. If the doctor says you're going to have a deformed child or whatever, it's okay to keep that child from suffering their whole life or something like some other thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that person is still going to be saved, right?
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of hard to
mm-hmm.
hard, you know, if but once you. I mean, it's almost better to be ignorant about it, everything, you know, because once you know, once you find out
mm-hmm.
what you're supposed to do, then God expects you to do it, you know?
Yeah, I don't think ignorance is ever bliss when it comes
but
to God.
I'm going to go, that's where I'm kind of against, basically I am against chemotherapy and all that, because it changes people. They can't make a rational decision.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm not saying it as an escape. I'm just saying I've listened to my mother over my dad. She goes, I wished I'd have never had him put on IRESA. I'd rather had him just die of the cancer than what I put him through by saying, put him on. And I think of your mom,
mm-hmm.
not the same woman anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Although she does function, she's not the same woman.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked for an Huntington cancer. I know what you're saying. There's no way I would make that decision.
And I'm not trying to make excuses for her.
I would
right.
not do
but
it.
But I'm yeah. sitting there going, yeah. a rational decision might have went out the door for her.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But she said, well, I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to fight this with this ugly chemical that'll actually kill your septic system.
I think what Tony's saying, though, it moves, if that foundation is there, it moves beyond rational in
right.
a moment.
Uh-huh.
And if it's part of you,
yeah.
you're not going to cover
yeah.
that up. I mean, if it's really mm-hmm. in your foundation, those principles, I don't think it's going to do that.
Yeah.
I attest to that. My grandma was like that. She had, you know, died of cancer. She was lucid till the day she died.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and she was probably one of the most solid Christians I've ever known. I don't think, and I think just because she had that foundation, there's nothing going to shake her from that.
Yeah, I believe
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because really what it comes down to, I mean, there's a war on, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you have to be prepared, you know, and being prepared, it's like so many things in life, the things that prepare you or put you in a good place are seemingly drudgery at times. They're small things. They're consistent things. It's like brushing your teeth. Like if you were born and as soon as you could learn language and you had understanding, and they said, okay, you're 3 or 4. I don't know how you know when you first can talk and figure things out. And your mom says, okay, the most important thing I have to tell you today, you're going to brush your teeth for 15 straight years or whatever, you know, or for 3 years, you know, if you add up all the time you're going to spend
okay.
brushing your teeth
okay.
from now till when you die, etc. set aside 2.5 years for brushing, or whatever it is. It's some long time. It's
it is.
You know, it might be a year, it might be 9 months.
15 years.
It might not be 15 years. it's a long time. And it's like, okay, you know,
right.
Set aside 10 months straight, 24 hours a day for brushing your teeth, and then for flossing, you know, so many more months or whatever it is, right? And if that's the way you saw it, you just fall over dead right then, right?
Right.
So
your teeth would fall out.
and there's aspects of the Christian walk, and not just the Christian walk, but everything in life. You know, there's aspects of life that are like that. There's these small things that are patterns, practices, whatever, and they characterize a lot of life, and they're a lot more important than we think they are. That's what I'm trying to say, you know. And they build little by little by little, time with God on a daily basis, or just being in the scriptures, or being in fellowship, whatever. They're changing you in little ways that you can't see. And it's good you can't see, too, half the time.
Yeah.
So you can't really see how these little things are going on, but it's the Holy Spirit and it's God, and He's moving you in a way where you're stronger and more founded, and you're thinking more like Jesus. You're renewing your mind, and you're thinking more like Jesus, so that when the unexpected test comes, you have a lot more to draw on than maybe you even think.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is when that's not happening, you don't know what you're not getting until the test comes and you fail. Mm-hmm. And you don't even know you're failing. So that's, you know, that's just some of the things I see here. And you know, and that's, you know, I think everybody in this room, I know everybody in this room just from the amount of time I've known each of you, that, and the fact that you're here the vast majority of the time, that you're in the category of people that are serious about hungering for God, or you wouldn't have been here so many times in so many boring Bible studies. You know,
every amount of years of Tony's Bible study takes.
There was a guy, I had a note from a guy I know in Mount Vernon who I used to do engineering with, and he's starting a Bible study in Habakkuk, and he sent me an email this morning or yesterday, Habakkuk or whatever, and he says, is Habakkuk relevant today? That was the title of his email, and then he went on to ask me, you know,
the Bible is.
I read. I'm going to do. I'm going to be in this Bible study in Habakkuk, and I've read through Habakkuk, and I just don't. It's just. It's depressing.
He says
it's depressing, and the world is so much like.
Going
That's exactly right. So I told him. I said, and he says, I just thought, not, you know, it's kind of, you know, the attitude behind it. He didn't get into the details, but it's kind of like, can you share with me something hopeful about what, you know? And I sent back with him, and I said, you've just, you know, and he said in there, it's like where we live today is almost like Habakkuk and da-da-da-da-da. And he's answering his question, is it relevant, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He just said out of your mouth, it's kind of like Habakkuk today. Why are you asking me if it's relevant, right? So I replied to him and I said,
please reread your email.
I said, yeah, there's this whole business of application, right? Observation, interpretation, application. And application, Habakkuk, is tremendously relevant for today, and especially the very last verse. Because in the last verse, he basically says, it doesn't matter if I understand what God's doing, and it doesn't matter if it's really harsh and all these things are falling apart, God's in control.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's like the key verse in the whole book, is that last verse. And I said to him, I said, look, these kind of Bible studies are hard. They're in a weird historic context that we don't know. It's like a dirge. And I said, look, we've been in Ezekiel, and I looked at my notes. We've been in Ezekiel since December of last year, and we're at chapter 20. And I said, most of it has been a dirge. And one of the chapters has like 61 verses of dirge. I said, a large portions of the Bible are teaching us, when you're in a dirge, don't think God's out of control. Don't be surprised. Mm-hmm. You're not the first people in the history of the church to have to walk through a time where it didn't make any sense things were happening. God was apparently using people who are like really ungodly and really vicious, and he's allowing them to do these terrible things to those who are supposed to be his people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And God's doing it.
And there it is in Habakkuk, here it is in Ezekiel, and guess what? It's in the book of Revelation too, mm-hmm. right? And so if you're a Christian, that if you're not ever going into these Old Testament prophets that where you have to ask the question, is it relevant for today? You're not. That's part of the foundation. That's part of this foundation. That it's not. It's like what you know. I mean, you were a weight, a bodybuilder. I've never done that, but I know there's a lot of things you do as a bodybuilder that's unpleasant. But the results are there. The results are there, and you can't get there without, you know, like people say, you know, you got to eat your your Brussels sprouts and your spinach, and this is kind of part of the thing.
Mostly while what I'm saying, I'm not saying don't tell her the truth. What I am saying is if she doesn't respond,
don't be surprised.
It's not your fault.
No, I know that. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. There's so much of the time we think, oh man, I wish maybe I could have said it different. No, for whatever reason,
mm-hmm.
if she couldn't grasp it, she can't grasp it.
Right.
And so I just... That's all I wanted to say. I'm not saying don't tell her. I'm saying this could be where you're, what you're, could be fighting.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so anyway, I told this guy, you know, you already know what Habakkuk's about, and you know it's relevant, and you're fine. Go in your Bible study.
Be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
My brother.
Find your
leaders.
Yeah. But you know, the big encouragement, to me,
just
you know, just
the Bible study. Yeah.
Or just being in a group of people that are all shaking their head. I mean, it's just like here. I mean, we're just average Joes here, and we see all this stuff too. We shake our head, but I'm not the only one shaking my head. Kevin's shaking his head. Down there, people are shaking their head, you know. And there's a, it's like Greg was talking about on Sunday, there's this whole unity of the body of Christ, that you're not alone. You're not on your own. When you think stuff's crazy, guess what? Other people think it's crazy too.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, but the craziest places in the church. I mean, her church is so under its own.
I know, that's the tragedy.
That's really frustrating.
Yeah.
I can handle the non-believers better than the believers that are teaching things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, you're right.
Yeah.
So, on to Ezekiel. Unless somebody else had more.
Let's have some drudgery.
Let's go to some drudgery.
We can vote.
Yeah.
When I said
Cap,
that's
back like a board. Yeah, like in Monty
Python. Yeah,
is that Moe or Curly?
I don't know. If they really, I don't know if they really did that or not. But.
Oh, well, actually, apparently, it was worse. They used to like whip themselves.
Oh yeah, self-flagellation. Yeah.
So,
they still do that in the Philippines. They creep by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I ask one quick question? Sorry.
Sure.
It's totally unrelated, and it can be brief. What is Advent? Like in context of. The month of December, as a Christian, what is Advent?
Okay.
Do you know what that is?
You could probably answer better than
what
me.
What is that?
It's
what?
Advent.
Oh.
Like Advent calendars?
I never paid that much attention.
A season of Advent. We're going into Advent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the, you know, it's talking about the advent of the birth of Christ, the arrival of the birth of Christ, and it's a series of things that, of I would say, I don't know that much about it, but from what I'm reading between the lines, see, this is one of those problems. If you're a biblical Christian, you focus on what's in the Bible, and people trot along all the time with religious stuff that has nothing to do with the Bible, and you don't know the first
Never
thing about
it.
Right? Lent, a bunch of things.
That's what it is.
And so their spiritual exercise is basically preparing people for Christmas,
is
my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Is that what you would say?
Yeah.
I mean, we're ignorant about it here, I guess.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't think my family ever really did that.
Right.
Yeah. It was all of a sudden Christmas, right after Thanksgiving.
So we can't really answer your question.
Yeah, I don't know.
You need to get a book on Catholicism.
So, but the disturbing part is that it's in being practiced by a Lutheran church. And the more I see about Lutheran church, the line between Catholicism and Lutheranism is paper thin.
Paper thin. It depends on the group. Depends on the Lutheran group.
There's several different types of
Lutheran. Yeah.
Yeah. Some are a lot more
visible. We used to do that in the Methodist Church, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I have to go look at an old catechism I have and see if that's there.
Sorry, I didn't mean it.
No. Well, so you
try to get ready for Christmas. So he's letting you know what he needs to do to help us.
No.
No, he knows we're going to go sing in that church, and he wants to make sure we're not suddenly being involved in something we shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So that basically, Lutheranism differentiated itself initially from Catholicism on really one key thing, which was, well, two, but one main one, which is salvation by faith. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the ritual and a lot of the other beliefs came across pretty close. Because,
mm-hmm.
For all the things he got right, Martin Luther was a Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things they have is that consubstantiation instead of transubstantiation. It's a little bit different view of, but it's still not our view of the Lord's Supper. It's like halfway between. So like Jerry says, you'll run into Lutherans who are pretty much like the non-denominational churches we attend here, or, Protestant churches we attend here. They're pretty much just like us, and others that are pretty close to Catholicism.
I've heard of the evangelical Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Wasn't Calvin Catholic? Or was he?
Yeah, he was as well. He was Catholic too. Both Luther and Calvin were Catholics that came to Christianity in the midst of it. Mm-hmm. Kind of biased thing.
Sounds like somebody in our group.
Yeah. Okay, so my first question I had for tonight. We're in Ezekiel 20:21. About verse 28, actually, right at near the very end. But I had a question, just to kind of remember. What very significant event is predicted in the first part, or most of Ezekiel 21 that we've covered so far? Just kind of remember. Verses 25 to 27 are focus in on it.
He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Right?
Okay, there's a destruction of Jerusalem.
At the end of the line for the kings.
Okay, yeah.
Is that what you're
after? Yeah. So the
Good
whole
job, Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry gets a star.
Woo-hoo.
Two stars. The whole book of Ezekiel is, a lot of it is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. It's pretty much a lot of it, yeah. But in this particular chapter, it focuses in a little bit more on the specifics of the overthrow of the throne and the bringing to the end the line of Davidic king, right? Remember we saw that? And so why would I focus on that in this chapter and say that's maybe the most important thing to pick up in this chapter overall? Why is that? Why is that important? How does it relate to anything else in the Bible? Or does it?
Because there's only one more kingdom coming after that.
Okay, so to back up from what you said, it has a huge relationship to Jesus in that. At the end, it says in verse 27, it's overthrown, I will make it overthrown, it shall be no longer, that is, the kingly rule, until he comes whose right it is, and I will give it to him.
Well, plus the last king in Israel signifies that starting of the times of the Gentiles.
Okay, right. So there's so why I'm saying this is so important here is because not only does it speak to the context and time of Ezekiel, it's understanding this is going to help us understand other things that are relevant. It's all relevant, but I just can't avoid it. When people always ask if the Bible's relevant, it's kind of interesting. But there are things that we deal with today and in the New Testament and that are themes even today among believers and worship songs and anything else that are tied to this little piece of information that this business of this Davidic rule on a particular throne that was given to David and the fact that Jesus comes. And so when we get to the book of Matthew and the other, when we get to the Gospels and we start reading about he's presenting this kingdom, now we can draw a line back to Ezekiel 21. Right? We can see here's the end, and it says, he who comes, whose right it is, and then all of a sudden we got this guy showing up later in the New Testament, and he's talking about the kingdom as if he's the king, potentially, right? And now we go, oh, these four Gospels are tied to Ezekiel 21. And there's a whole lot that comes with that, besides the fact that we start to understand the focus, Jesus is having this focus on the kingdom, and we can understand that there's been this interruption, and there's this period of time where there's no king on the throne. And when he comes talking about the kingdom, he's essentially saying the king is here who could sit on that throne. And by the way, if you know Ezekiel 21, you'll understand better the significance of what I'm talking about. And then the other aspect of that is, like Kevin said, there's this whole issue of when Jesus talks about the times of the Gentiles in Luke 21, we understand that you get the picture when you start looking at this, and along with the book of Daniel, where the visions and stuff are, you start to understand that there's a big theme in the Bible where God is had this rule through the Jewish line, and he's cut it off, and he's given focus over into the Gentile powers surrounding Israel for this period of time. And until Jesus is on that throne, that's the times of the Gentiles, right? So when Jesus, you know, not only do we understand the Gospels that, oh, there's Jesus is presenting this kingdom, what's that have to do with, why is that so significant? It's not just because he's God, and that's a big thing, okay? But it's not just because he's God, and it's not just because he's the Messiah, it's also because it was cut off here. And there's a promise and an expectation that it's going to be given to him whose right it is, right? The other thing it helps us with is we got all these liberal critics and even believers that are kind of have a low view of Scripture that think that the Gospels are all goofed up and fragmentary and goofy memories, maybe distorted of some Jesus guy that the church made up. And you get away from that whole idea when you start to realize, wow, these little details are all tied in a supernatural way, essentially, and it moves you further away. Not that there's anyone here that struggles with that anyway, but in general, if you struggle with thinking, well, how can I trust the Gospels? Here's some more evidence that the Gospels are very carefully crafted and tied in with Ezekiel. And it's not because Matthew went and studied Ezekiel. It's because the Holy Spirit, you know, directed all that. So it helps us to understand this whole issue of the times of the Gentiles, the importance of Jesus presenting the kingdom, and the fact that the king got crucified instead of being on a throne is pretty important, because it tells us too that this promise, even though it had the potential in Jesus' offer, didn't come to fruition, and so the promise is still outstanding, right? So all of that comes from kind of taking this and looking at other parts of Scripture and fitting it together, and you can start to see, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, if you're like me, you've probably read through Ezekiel 21 a lot of times and not really you know, it's you know, you're doing your devotional reading, you're going through it, and it's like, you know, take a breath and go through it, and you've probably read through, you know, this passage quite a few times. And I know for me, the very first time that I was reading through it, and I had enough background in some of these other things to see the significance of verse 25 through 27, you know, the hairs went up on the back of my neck. It was like, oh, I now, for the very first time when I'm reading this, I understand the importance of these three verses and how significant they are in this bigger thing that God is doing with the kingdom, that you kind of, it's kind of, you kind of lose it here because it's immersed in all this drudgery and the prophet and all these things going on. So you get this feeling like you lose track of it. Oh yeah, you guys don't know, there's little girls back there.
Oh, we can't hear.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I forgot they were here.
Oh, yeah. My granddaughters. They're back there playing.
Aaron's voice wasn't ringing in my ear.
So any comments or thoughts about that aspect?
Good point.
Or any questions about it? Okay.
I have a question that doesn't relate to this. But it has to do with God leaving the temple.
Yeah.
Were the sacrifices valid after God left the temple?
My answer just off the cuff without having thought about it a lot would be yes. Partly because of what happened when the veil was torn later. There, you don't see any evidence of the same sort of response by God. I mean, the temple eventually gets destroyed. But to the degree that the people are still, some of them, at least half-heartedly, whatever, going through the motions of what God has asked them to do, it seems to me it's still valid.
Okay.
And also the idea that in the second temple that was built after this, right, you have Paul doing things and other Christians doing things, and certainly Jesus considered the sacrifices and the system that was in place there to be valid, and there was no evidence of the glory dwelling there in that temple until Jesus shows up, right? So I would have to say that I think it was still valid. I don't know. So, who wants to read the last 20 verses 28 through 32 of Ezekiel 21 to get us started?
I will.
Okay.
And you, son of man, prophesy and say, less easy
I'm
for
not
me
sure
to say.
That's what he said.
All right.
The coughing prophet.
Thus says the Lord God concerning the Ammonites and concerning their reproach, and say, a sword is drawn, polished for slaughter, for consuming, for flashing, while they see false visions for you, while they divine a lie to you, to bring you on the necks of the wicked, the slain, whose day has come, whose iniquity shall end, return it to its sheath, I will judge you in the place where you were created, in the land of your nativity. I will pour out my indignation on you. I will blow against you with the fire of my wrath and deliver you into the hands of brutal men who are skillful to destroy. You shall be fuel for the fire. Your blood shall be in the midst of the land. You shall not be remembered, for I, the Lord, have spoken. That's a little light reading.
Yeah.
Garfield, you know, Ezekiel 21.
Yeah. So this is like just like what we were talking about. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So who are the Ammonites? What are the Ammonites? Is that like a fossil? What is that?
They're actually, I think they're relatives of Abraham's second wife, what was her name? Katira?
Those are the Son of Lot. It's hard to keep track of them all. The Son of Lot. That's the one where his daughters got him drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the names help you can help you to remember a little bit. It's in Genesis 39, but basically the two sons are named Ben-Ami and Moab.
Mm-hmm.
And Moab means basically from dad. So she slept with her father.
Yeah.
From dad. And Ben-Ami means the son of my people, basically from my own stock.
But one of those is also an eventual mother of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ruth.
Because they're both daughters.
Ruth the Moabitess, right? Isn't she a Moabitess?
Yeah.
No, it was... I'm drawing a blank now. But it was...
You think of Hagar?
Mm-mm.
No?
No, I'm thinking of one of those two daughters. Does it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, well. Yeah, I know Ruth is in the line.
Solomon, no, one of his wives was an Ammonite.
Yeah.
She was the mother of Rehoboam.
Rehoboam.
Yeah.
Rehoboam. Yeah, that doesn't, that's not. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he'd be the southern. But what? Yeah, let's see. I don't know. I'd have to go look. I'm not putting that together entirely. I know Ruth's in the line, and she's a Moabitess.
Yeah.
So, for sure, at least one is. And, I mean, the fact that Rahab and Ruth are both in the line from Messiah. And, you know, it's like God goes out of his way to say,
mm-hmm.
well, even though something's really messed up, I'm still going to use it. And so, you know how you're all messed up? I can use you too.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did we see Ammon last mentioned? Do you remember? Hint, it's in this chapter.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, you know, we haven't been doing anything for 2 weeks.
20.
Okay, so what does it say there?
Appoint a road for the sword to go to Rabbah of the Ammonites, and to Judah into fortified Jerusalem.
Rabbah. Okay. So the king of Babylon is coming down, and he's gotten his mind to beat some people up, and he's like, where am I going to go first? And there's a fork in the road, and I'm going to use some divination, you know, get some chicken kidneys or whatever it is, livers or whatever. Whatever he does there. And and God directs him to Jerusalem first, right? And so this Ezekiel is basically saying, you know, by the way, if you're reading this as an Ammonite, look, he's going down to Jerusalem, he's going to womp on Jerusalem. And so as an Ammonite, you're thinking, good deal, right? I'm off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
So now Ezekiel's saying, coming back and saying, well, no, that's just the first punch,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, he went down to Jerusalem first, but he's going to get you too. And so you're not going to escape this judgment of God. And what you'll see too, biblically often, is people that God gets upset about, especially some of these ites that are kind of hard to trace or not that familiar. There's often situations where if you read in other places in the Old Testament, you find out they did something kind of nasty, or they're going to do something nasty, and you can't, without knowing that, you don't really understand, you know, why, you know, like the place where Samuel tells Saul off, and then he hacks this guy to pieces, and why does he go nuclear and hack the guy to pieces? It has to do with things that God has said earlier. So there's these connections like that, and this is one of those situations where the people they're enemies of Israel, but they ally themselves with Israel against Nebuchadnezzar. So, you know, it's like when you have a bigger enemy, then you become friends for a while, right? And then, but they rejoiced, essentially, they rejoiced to see Jerusalem sacked by Nebuchadnezzar. And there's even a situation you read about in Jeremiah, which of course is a prophet about the same time period, where after Nebuchadnezzar comes in and destroys Jerusalem, he sets up kind of a puppet governor there. And it's the Ammonites who send a guy across who eventually assassinate him. But that guy who's set up as a Jewish governor, you get the impression reading through it that God was in support of that. And so there's this issue, like Jerry talked about a bunch of times, we've talked about it a bunch, where God gets upset with Israel, his people, whatever, he whacks on them with somebody, but if they rejoice in what he's doing, then they're in trouble, right? So there's, when God, it's like when God judges sin, he doesn't want the people who are being used in that judgment to exalt themselves about it, like, oh, we're better than our enemy, God's for us because we clouded them or whatever. And in fact, often they're in as bad or worse a shape, just like Babylon, right? He's bringing down Babylon in here, which is Habakkuk's all about. It's like, how could you use these horrible people as your means of discipline? You know, how is it you, the holy God, would even mess with these killers, right? And so that whole thing comes through a lot of times, and that's the situation here where Ammon ends up being an enemy of Israel and rejoicing in the overthrow of Israel. And Ezekiel, God through Ezekiel is aware of that, and he's saying, look, you're going to get sacked too.
So you could loosely apply that today. If God uses a church pastor in discipline of another member of the church, that should not cause any rejoicing. You know, there should be a sober, heart to that. You know, you have to do it, and it's not quite the same because you're not an enemy of that person. But still, the principle kind of overlaps a little bit. It should be a difficult thing to do.
If you think about it, it makes perfect sense that God would use Babylon, because why would he bring some peaceful nation down to kill everybody, right? He's going to bring
Yeah, and so there's the other thing that you see in these situations is there's this constant challenge for believers. God wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do it that way. He wouldn't allow this. He wouldn't, and that's where, if you're seeing this, and just like Psalm 74, where Asaph goes on about, Lord, I don't get it. How come all this sinful stuff is prospering and nothing's ever judging it, right? So there's this whole situation where the scriptures, I think, are actively trying to keep us from too simplistic a view of the sovereignty of God. You know, what is he willing to allow? What isn't he willing to allow? In allowing the outer working of rebellion and sin to flower and show itself and manifest and still bring about his plan. He does not offer it, but, and I think he, in every dimension you can think of God, whether it's justice, perfection, holiness, love, sacrifice, he goes beyond where we can follow, right? And so the love of God, he loves in a way that offends us, right? The judgment of God, he does things that we think are too harsh. In our limited thinking, we think, oh, that's too harsh. Which is why a lot of people rail against the Bible. Oh, look at God, the Old Testament God, he's a butcher, he does this, he does that. So all these different dimensions of God, he's just so big. And And so part of, I think, what the Bible is doing all the time is it's like what Mary does, stretching muscles or whatever. It's stretching. it's stretching yeah. us. Going, yeah. You know, you woke up today and you had this certain concept of God's, how severe he can be. Well, he can be more severe than that. You woke up today, you had a certain concept about how loving God could be. Well, he can be more loving than that. So there's this, it's almost like exercise where if we don't keep being reminded of, I don't know how to say it, the extremes of God, we just have a concept of a smaller God than he really is. And then when he does something different, we can't track with it, right? Like, was it you that talked about the woman that said, my God's not an all-consuming fire? Was it you?
I remember that.
I was in a group.
Okay, we were in a group. Was it the group we were teaching in? I'm trying to remember.
I think it was somebody who my God's not like that.
Right, so we had somebody who was kind of new to the group, and we were in a passage where it talks about God being an all-consuming fire, and that's talking about judgment. And she got up and said, you know, my God's not an all-consuming fire, and left.
I think it's on the Wednesday night.
You know.
How can you believe in and put your faith in a God that only responds according to how you feel is right? Yeah. I mean, how can that... Then you're all your trust is really in your own idea.
Yeah.
I don't trust my idea. I mean, that's just... I don't even get how you can... Put your faith in a God like that.
I'm right with you, Mary. I just love to hear you pop off on that stuff because it's like and music to me.
What I see that we do, though, is because we are limited in our ability to handle situations. God is an all-consuming fire, but he never sets aside his other attributes in the midst of those things. And we can, you know, we can... lose our temper, you know, and all of a sudden the grace and the love does not exist for a moment. I mean, that happens, right? But it doesn't happen with him. I mean, he's revealing, he's acting this out, but those are still involved, you know. And I mean, it's just he doesn't. So, you know, she's not maybe seeing that part. Well, if he's an all-consuming fire, he's just mean and. All these other things that we talk about, the love and the mercy and the grace and all those things, well, those must not be, he's not those then, you know, but yes, he is. So.
The person who makes up their image of God is actually acting as God themselves, and they're making up the God that they want. And that's happened ever since. We wanted to be God.
Yeah, when you make up your own God, you make up a God you can control.
Yeah,
but then you're in big trouble because you can't control what happens to you after you die. So how's that God going to help you?
Never said it was rational.
It makes perfect sense.
As the world would think, it makes perfect sense. Absolutely. You know, you ever look at pictures of, I don't know why I'm thinking, you look at Jesus people that have Jesus in China and they had him, you know, maybe they'll make up a statue of him. He'll have Chinese characteristics for features. So they're making up a Christ that looks not Hebrew. That's probably a Roman version. Italian.
Is that pizza they're eating?
I like it.
Root beer and pizza.
Yeah.
Anchovies.
Not pork sausage.
Not pork sausage.
So.
Anchovies, I like to see a Galilee.
So this is one of the things that is a challenge for us when we're going through the book of Ezekiel like that. A friend of mine, going to Habakkuk is, you know, getting a a balanced diet of all God's attributes is really what we're after. I mean, that's one of the reasons, like for me, like when I'm reading through the Bible, I follow the schedule where I get both Old Testament and New Testament every day. Not that you can't just read, you know, through it, that's fine, but and not that there isn't all those characteristics in both halves, it's just there's definitely a greater emphasis in one than the other, and so you kind of need to be reminded constantly, this is what, you know, it's almost like riding a bike with training wheels where you're a little kid and you can't really keep the bike balanced right, you're on one side or the other side, and so then there's these training wheels, and these passages are like, to me, they're like that training wheel thing. It's just like when you have a steady diet of these really amazing, loving passages of God, and you're just focused on those, you know, a lot, the bike starts leaning, you know, over one direction, and then the training wheel has to catch you and go, no, there's the judgment, perfection, there's holiness, mm-hmm. and push you back so that you kind of stay upright as you're going along in your view of God. But I think it does really help avoid that whole business of building, you know, because I think this whole business of idolatry is a really subtle thing. I mean, it's one thing to build an image and set it on or put it up in your house and, you know, bow down before it, but I think all of us who are trying to study and understand God and get nearer God are challenged because we can't understand Him entirely. And we have part of what the scriptures are doing as we're in the scriptures is they're continually, you know, it's like Michelangelo, he starts out with this big block and there's nothing, and then he chips away and out comes a famous statue, right? And so as a Christian, that's kind of like our view of God. It's continually forming and refining, and the Holy Spirit and the Bible are chipping away the little misconceptions that we have, little erroneous ideas, getting us to a more accurate picture of what God is. And so some of that chipping comes from passages that we'd rather not spend time in and study and dwell in because they're on the face of it, they're depressing. You know, I mean, verse 28 to 32, on the face of it, it's pretty depressing going, right? It's like, get on your waders and slog through the mud.
Sure, he's right.
And notice, you know, there are times where, like with Sodom and Gomorrah, where he brings fire out of the sky, or the book of Revelation, he brings asteroids, whatever. But here, again, in verse 31, I'll deliver you into the hands of brutal men. Mm-hmm. You know, just the vast majority of the time, God gets his work done through other nations, other people groups.
So what happens now when Babylon goes and is done with Jerusalem? Do they turn and go against Ammon?
Babylon itself?
Yeah, or who does God use? I don't know the thing.
Yeah, I don't know as much about the details of that because, again, the scriptures focus mostly on Israel, but Ammon definitely came under attack.
They no more, so.
Yeah, they came under attack by Babylon. So one of the challenges that you have, again, as you're studying the scriptures, is the scriptures themselves are virtually the only really reliable old historic witness. Like I said before, if you buy some histories of Israel, you know, by secular people who completely reject the Bible, they go back so far, and then pretty soon it's the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, it's the only thing they can go on that they have, and it's reliable. So they're kind of forced to after a while.
It's kind of funny to read Wikipedia when on some of those older, like the older civilizations in the Bible, they're trying to keep away from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So having said that, though, there's the Bible doesn't cover everything that happens, right? It just covers the main things that is significant. So there's whole in some of the details of what we know historically, you know.
Because we don't.
Christianity.
No, that's the area of Jordan now.
Yeah, southern. Well, yeah, and there and on the, by the Sea of north of the Dead Sea.
Dead Sea.
Yeah. So. Well, I guess we're pretty much at 8:30. That clock's a little bit slow there. The phone is right on atomic time.
Atomic time.
That rooster is atomic time. That's an atomic rooster.